the Danielle Strickland Podcast. We're glad you're here. For more information on what Danielle does, go to daniellestrickland.com.
Welcome to Mind-Blowing Books That We Love and Hate. It's complicated.
It's so complicated.
I'm Danielle Strickland.
My name is James Scholl.
And we're excited to be here. There's a lot of books still, but we're going to try to wrap up this section and go to one more section. Like, we're just going to try to get this over with. It's basically the best that we possibly can.
We just have too much fun. This is always the problem. When I started this, I'm like, okay, so a week for each of these things. And then we thought, well, maybe two. And then on like week four of profits, we're like, well, that's...
Yeah, it turns out boundaries aren't our best. Maybe we should add boundaries to the books that we recommend. Have you read that? Boundaries by... Cloud. It's a classic, by Cloud and Townsend.
I was encouraged to read it, and I read it, and I thought, this is stupid. Why doesn't everyone just do this naturally? And the person in charge of me at the time said, James, I think there's three people that read this book, and the first of those that read it and find it incredibly helpful and life-changing, and those who kind of enjoy it and... but don't, you know, it's not that important. And then there's people that think it's pointless. And those are those that need to be aware of other boundaries. And I'm like, you talking about me there? Am I the third one?
So those people.
Naming no names for the third parties in which
I did, interesting, like I did boundary classes with women that I worked with, like my whole life.
They find it helpful?
So essential. Like some of the things in that book are just so, like you said, normal, but actually... if you're raised in a certain way, they're not normal. And you don't know what's happening, but you know that this is dysfunctional, right?
Well, it begins as like, I'm like, why would you do a thing you don't want to do? I don't understand.
Right, that's why I do it with women.
Yeah, weirdly, being a white man in this world.
Do what you don't want to do? I don't understand.
Just do what you want all the time? Is that not everyone's lived experience?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, we're on theological
living.
This is
my final episode of Mind Blown and the end of my friendship. So.
No, it takes a lot more than that. I could name a few things, but we don't have to go there. Oh, boy. Okay, theological living gems. We're still here.
We're still here. The people we're talking about are still here and still doing their thing and still writing.
And we're thankful.
Some of them have been writing a while. Some of them are newer, but really important voices to the conversation about, like prophetic living gems, people that tell us how things should be.
Yeah, and also like a living, like theology is really just the what you think about when you think about God. Yeah. You know, it's thoughts about God. And so what I love about these theological gems, what we're calling theological gems, is their thoughts about God that kind of they've stayed with me.
Yeah.
Like they're things that, and all these books are this way, they're things that have actually had an impact. They're things that I keep thinking about and that have profoundly opened up new ways of thinking about things. So I think they're worthy. Now we have gotten some feedback from people going like, can you stop with the books? Cause like my list is long and I don't need another 12, but
also there's no short books today. I feel like that's my thing. I like recommending short books. There's no short books.
Yeah. Some theological gems tend to be a little bit like weightier, right? Like meatier, but actually the prophetic imagination is a short book.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, then I'll definitely read
that. And here's a little note, everybody. James has not read that book, which is like unbelievable.
This is very embarrassing.
It's really shameful. I'm shaming him publicly.
A lot of street cred with my prophetic-y friends that listen to this. We're like, how?
Yeah, I think The Prophetic Imagination is one of those pivotal books that like changed, like literally shifted conversation and insight. I feel like you're already there.
I'll tell people, you know what I mean? I'm like, oh yeah, Brueggemann is one of the guys. You've got to be reading him, got to listen. And then people ask him like, oh. So I believe you.
Yeah, and he's written a lot, and we're going to end with him, so let's not. But he's written a lot, and there's a lot of good things to read by Brueggemann, but there is one signature book that we're going to mention. But anyway, let's begin where we want to begin. Where do we want to begin?
Who do we want to begin with?
I thought we were beginning with Wolf.
Yeah, that's a good call. So we're going to talk about Miroslav Volf for a while.
Yep.
His book, Exclusion and Embrace. One of the reasons, okay, I'm going to make a confession. This is embarrassing now. One of the reasons I love this book is because he quotes Jürgen Moltmann so much,
right,
which is If you listen to the last episode, you'll know I'm super into Jürgen Moltmann. Also, on the back of the book, the first recommendation is from Jürgen Moltmann. I'm like, well, yeah, he basically quotes you the whole time. So if you don't like it, I think you're in trouble. I'm going to make a confession here, Danielle. I've only read the first half of this book.
That is a funny confession.
It's also not because it's not an amazing... It's amazing. It's beautiful. It's a problem I have that, like, if I read a book,
that's
to the
why
end,
you like short books.
Yeah, exactly. Like, right. I'm only going to read 100 pages of your book. So right. If the book's 100 pages, I'm going to read all of it.
I
certainly missed out a lot in this book.
Well, yeah, the ending's pretty good.
Okay,
and we'll talk about that. But also, just a disclosure: this is a thick theological book. I mean, this is not like light reading.
Read it slow, and it's really deep.
And you know, one of the things I think is important, we keep talking about this, but like, is where people are writing from. Mm-hmm. So Miroslav Volf is from that Serbian Croatian civil, like war, like massacre really.
Yep.
And was part of that, out of that place was wrestling with his thoughts about God. And so he's coming again from another culture, from like this place of absolute violence and pain and suffering and death and like bad guys winning and like, you know, just, I mean, all these where none of the Christian platitudes or like normal thoughts about God are going to work out.
Mm.
And so he's struggling through what his theology, which is nonviolent theology, like he's struggling through like, how on earth does this make any sense in the context of this background that I'm in, this culture that I'm in. So coming from that place, I feel like he is spouting some beautiful theological truths, but I just think the rootedness in this real life, you know, the difference between like waxing eloquent about God and then actually having to like sit with people who suffer and who have suffered and don't have anywhere to go and don't know what to do next, like to actually craft some thoughts about God there is, I don't know, it's really profound.
Yeah. And again, the question he's asking is that he understands the importance of including everyone and recognizing that everyone is created in that divine image, whilst also taking very seriously the cruelties that humanity inflicts upon one another. And that's what I got from the first half of the book.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah.
But he asks these questions seriously, and I think what's really important is he writes so clearly about the idea of suffering and what it means to find an ally in Jesus. This is one line that has struck me. He says that all sufferers can find comfort in the solidarity of the crucified. But only those who struggle against evil by following the example of the crucified will discover him at their side. To claim the comfort of the crucified while rejecting his way is to advocate not only for cheap grace, but a deceitful ideology.
Wow. You know, that goes with a little quote here, and it's a much bigger quote in the context, but I really, really love this. I might just read this whole paragraph. It's from page 86. If you have this book and you want to have a look at it, but he says in this book, The Killing of Sarajevo, a soldier in the Serbian army says to his best friend living in Sarajevo, the city, which was even as they spoke, being pounded with Serbian shells. There is no choice. There are no innocents. The two claims seem inseparable, since there is no choice, since as the same friend will later say, it is either us or them, there can be no innocence. And since there are no innocents, there must have been no choice. Though it has a ring of truth, the logic is faulty. Within the vast expanse of non-innocence, whose frontiers recede with the horizon, there are choices to be made, important choices about justice and oppression, truth and deception, violence and non-violence, about the will to embrace or to exclude, ultimately choices about life and death. The no-choice world in which people's behavior is determined by social environments and past victimizations is not the world we inhabit. It is a world the perpetrators would like us to inhabit because it grants an advanced absolution for any wrongdoing they desire to commit. So he says, suspicion is called for when, from behind a smoking howitzer, we hear the words, there is no choice. And I think I love it. I love it because I actually think that to choose is to be human. To be choose. So I actually think when I was reading that, and I have this like growing, I think like thoughts about this holy thing called choice. Like it's this whole, and literally like all through the Old Testament, God's like, I give you the choice literally from like the very beginning, choose life. Mm. But you have the choice of life or death, but choose life, choose life, choose life. And then Jesus comes and gives us a way again to choose again. Like, so we've suffered under this idea of like, we can't choose it. We have no choice. And then Jesus is like, oh no, let me show you. You can choose. I'll choose. Yeah. I'll choose suffering. I'll choose solidarity. I'll choose death. So I think this idea of like the human, the part of God's design in making humanity was to embed choice in what it means to be human. So every time we have anything that's like, I don't have any choices, it is unhuman. Mm-hmm. It's either oppression, it's sin, it's deception. So that really hit me hard because I think he's right. Like there's so many, it's such an easy smokescreen to say, I had no choice.
Yeah.
I had no choice. And you, even from like little things like, well, like not, that's not little. If it's somebody's husband or spouse or something, he's like, I had an affair because I had no choice. My heart decided. And you're just like, no, that's rubbish. You have a choice. Everybody has a choice, right? To like a soldier in a war, you know, fighting, saying like, I choose this or I can't choose. I don't choose. It's been chosen for me. And then you're like, no, that's not right. That's not human. That's not what God designed.
And even you look at the way, and perhaps this is a tangent, I don't think so, though, that we look at the way that we've treated those who, again, during conscription have said, I make the choice to not take part, and they will be imprisoned or ostracized or anything. But like, no, I have a choice here. And something, again, wonderfully human about, I make a choice which is going to remove a bunch of choices from me ultimately, right. But like, it will be my choice.
Right.
And those, again, those are the stories that endure.
And who is it that said to not to choose is to choose? Right? Not to choose is itself a choice.
Yeah.
Like, and it was around like, if you choose to do nothing, you've sided with the oppressor kind of thing. Like it's that idea that like to not use your choice is to misunderstand what it means to be human, I think, and what God is doing in the world. And this is what, you know, one of the things I love about God too, is that possession is only demonic. Possession, like the devil takes you over and you end up doing things that are outside of your control. Partnership is God.
Yeah.
God is always participating with humanity. He's always saying, hey, sending angels, don't be afraid, but this is my invitation to you. And then people are choosing God. And then even to ridiculous efforts, like with Jesus, like calling a blind man to him and saying, what would you like me to do? Every single thing he does is giving choice back to people who have been told they don't have any choices. To the layman, pick up your bed and walk, right? To the lepers, go into the city and show yourself. I mean, it goes all through Jesus's ministry is this incredible return of choice to people who have been taught and told and believe their whole lives that they have no choices. So I think there's that's such a profound theological truth that if it's oppressive, if it's demonic, you have no choices. And actually, this has been a good thing for me to keep in mind, because whenever I slip into that, well, I don't really have a choice. And whether that's if you're working for a group of people that are just like, I'm telling you to do this and you have no say or you have no choice, then that's not from God. God is always in partnership. There's always a dialogue. There's always an invitation. There's always this ability. You're part of this choice. So to actually find that choice again is really what it means to encounter God and to be human.
And understanding that probably often it will mean less like convenience, or less like convenience even, the choices that, I don't know, a choice I make, I'm trying not to buy things from Amazon, I don't know, because they're evil, right? Like they rob, again, an Amazon worker doesn't have the choice of going to the bathroom. Like that's, again, there is a...
That's dehumanizing. And that worker really should choose to go to the bathroom. And then all of them should.
And yeah. That's,
but anyway.
That's, yeah, our dirty protest advice to those on the... but what that meant was, in order to buy gifts, I had to like leave the house and pay more money and do all of these things. And again, but that's a choice I made. And I'm not really trying to make myself the hero here. My point is that 99% of the time, I just take the easy option.
Yes.
But as one with a choice, what does it mean to actually, and I feel better for it. I feel awesome. I feel I feel much more aligned having made the effort and spent more money and giving that money to a local store and those things. So
I'm not there yet.
To be clear, sorry. I'm not great.
I'm with you though in sentiment.
Danielle, who is wonderfully gifted and generous in other ways,
I'm trying. Aaron White always challenges me. Whenever he visits me, he's always like, "There's a lot of packages coming to this house." I'm like, so "No,
exercise your humanity, Danielle.
I'm getting there. Okay, well, do you want to know the end of this book, or do you have another one?
I mean, there was only one other line that really stood out to me, because, again, I love this tension throughout this whole book of him knowing, I know I'm supposed to embrace the outcast, mm-hmm. but also that outcast has ruined my life, so yeah. What does that do?
Killed my family, like, made my life miserable, right?
One of the lines he says is that by embracing the outcast, which he puts in scare quotes, Jesus underscored the sinfulness of the persons and systems that cast them out.
Mm.
And I love, again, what a wonderful example that is of who Jesus is, that Jesus embracing those that aren't welcome,
mm-hmm.
all it does is expose the evils of those that chuck them out. And man, we seem to be in a place like that with Christianity right now, where we got to do a lot more embracing and revealing the some of the
because the embrace actually is a means by which it exposes what's actually in our hearts, like our own prejudice and angst.
Yeah. All right, tell me how the ending of this book, spoiler alert for anyone, like, stop listening for the next minute.
Only went for 100 pages, but if you keep going, James, it's a beautiful end. Gold, yeah. So he basically, you know, well, let me read this, and this visits sort of what we were talking about where he was writing from. So he says, my thesis that the practice of nonviolence requires a belief in divine vengeance will be unpopular with many Christians, especially theologians in the West. To the person who's inclined to dismiss it, I suggest imagining that you're delivering a lecture in a war zone, which is where a paper that underlies this chapter was originally delivered. Among your listeners are people whose cities and villages have first been plundered, then burned and leveled to the ground, whose daughters and sisters have been raped, whose fathers and brothers have had their throats slit. The topic of the lecture, a Christian attitude toward violence, the thesis, we should not retaliate since God is perfect, non-coercive love. Soon you would discover that it takes the quiet of a suburban home for the birth of the thesis that human nonviolence corresponds to God's refusal to judge. In a scorched land soaked in the blood of the innocent, it will invariably die. And as one watches it die, one will do well to reflect about many other pleasant captivities of the liberal mind. He actually is taking a page out of Bonhoeffer, right, who, when he was really highly criticized for being involved in a plot to overthrow Hitler, people really criticized him, and he said, it must be nice to have the space and thought to criticize my actions in the midst of trying to stop evil. So, but what he's saying, and this is what he's actually saying, is not an excuse to retaliation or to perpetual violence. He's actually making a case for nonviolence. What he's saying is that there will be a reckoning. Like, there will be a judge. It's just not ours. It's not ours. So there will be, and this is like, you can't tell people who have been completely annihilated that there's nothing to be done and God's totally fine. Like, God is on the side of those who've been oppressed. So there is a sense in which there is a reckoning coming. There is justice coming, but it's just not ours. And then what he says is, he says, like, there is this, like, there's this thought that we're stuck in this inevitable sort of pattern of violence, and there's no way to escape it. And this is, like, humanity's best. You know, this is what they have. Violence had the first word in history. It'll have the last word and most of the words in between, too. That's kind of like humanity's sum up of the reality of violence. But he says this, contrast the image of the struggle against war with the vision of peace we find in the Bible. And then he quotes from the prophet Isaiah, which in verse 11, where a shoot shall come out of the stump of Jesse and a branch shall grow out of his roots. He's talking about Jesus. And then, of course, it's like the wolf shall live with the lamb and the leopard shall lie down with the kid and the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child will lead them, and a cow and a bear shall graze. Their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and a nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den, and they will not hurt or destroy. So in the text, we had not referred to wolves. If the text had not referred to wolves and lambs, this is wolf. to the needy and the wicked, the children and the cobras, we would have been tempted to think that it is a world that has nothing to do with our own. But it is a vision of our world freed from injustice and destruction, our world in which peace rather than terror has the last word. Violence is not human destiny because the God of peace is the beginning and the end of human history. The biblical vision of peace invites, however, a task much more difficult than anyone else's. Granted, pushing the stone of peace up the steep hill of violence, doing those small neighborly acts of help, even though one knows that the killer might return the next day, the next week or year, is hard. It is easier, however, than carrying one's own cross in the footsteps of the crucified Messiah. And this is what Jesus Christ asked Christians to do. Assured of God's justice and undergirded by God's presence, they are to break the cycle of violence by refusing to be caught in the automatism of revenge. Anyway, it goes like that.
Well, I love that. I have to read the rest of this book now. Yeah.
I love that idea of if he hadn't used our world, we could say, oh, this is heaven. But he uses all the imagery of our world, the violence that exists, that system of, violence that exists within our world. And then he says, this world, this is going to happen here. And that's just a beautiful thing to hang on to.
That's a really profound, I'm preaching on peace this Sunday and I found my ending. That's the ending, right?
That's it. Thank you, Wolf.
Thanks, Wolf. Sure I should have read the rest of the book.
That's right. If only you had got there yourself, but that's okay. That's what this podcast is for.
You're welcome.
Yes. Yes. Okay, we got a couple more to talk about. We're going to try to squeeze in here. That was a long one for Wolf, but I thought...
It was inevitable. It was going to be long.
Yeah, it was inevitable. It's a big work that he did.
I think, we're talking about peacemaking a little bit at the end there, which blends almost perfectly into Esau Macaulay, who wrote a book, Reading While Black.
Yes.
It either came out last year or the year before. This is a recent one, which is, it's pretty telling. If a recent book makes this list,
it's
because it's something quite special.
Yeah.
And that book was always important, but in the light of Black Lives Matter protests, in the wake of increasing either violence against people of color or awareness of people against color, I'm not sure which one of those is more prevalent or worse, but we know that both are. There's too much of both. He writes something different.
Yeah, and also I think it was also what happens, I think, when something like Black Lives Matter happened is not that you're aware of racism in general, but you start to begin to be aware of your blindness to racism in general. And so I think one of the things that Esau did was, this book does, is it brings to our awareness that there actually have been Black theologians and gospel thought from Black theologians across history, including Augustine, by the way. He might have been the first one, and everyone quotes Augustine thinking he's a white guy. But anyway, and on and on this goes.
They're literally African theologians.
They're African theologians. And they're always having, they're beautiful, this celebration. And so Esau, I think this is happening all over the place, but from a theological tradition. And he even talks a lot about even Black preachers and the way that they exegete the scriptures being so different from, and for years and years being dismissed as not being academic enough or being theologically robust enough. And Esau kind of visits it and is like, actually, if the truth be known, they're more theologically rigorous, but just from a different perspective. So there's something beautiful about discovering the voices of Black theologians and Black theology from this book.
Yeah.
Also, guys, it's super readable.
Yeah, it's very readable. It's not too long. It gets like a 7 out of 10 for James's readability length.
Yeah.
One of the lines that popped out to me, and it kind of blends with what we've been talking about, that talking about peacemaking. Peacemaking then cannot be separated from truth telling. The church's witness does not simply involve denouncing the excesses of both sides and making moral equivalencies. It involves calling injustice by its name. If the church is going to be on the side of peace in the United States, and it goes here as well, I think whilst he's speaking from a specifically African-American context, if you don't think that applies to wherever you're at, I would encourage you to spend more time with people different to you. Mm-hmm.
Here's more from, this is the chapter Black and Proud, the Bible and Black Identity. And he quotes Song of Solomon 1:1, I am black and beautiful, O daughters of Jerusalem. So even like just from the scriptures itself, I mean, we've so whitened everything. I actually saw a meme this week where it had like a black Joseph and a black Mary, and they gave birth to a little white baby. And they were like, wonder of wonders. Like, and I was like, right. Anyway, historically, the claim that Christianity is European is fundamentally false. This can easily be proved by anyone with access to a history book and a map. It is a fact hiding in plain sight that the three major centers of early Christianity were the patriarchs of Rome, Antioch, and Alexandria. Of these three, only Rome is in what we call Western Europe. Alexandria is located in Egypt, a major early center of African culture. We do not have firm information on how Christianity came to North Africa, but tradition has it that it was evangelized by St. Mark. From this North African church comes some of the greatest minds that Christianity has produced, such as Augustine and Tertullian. And this, this idea that this fundamental criticism that black Christianity is some sort of an imposter and white Christianity is the original. And he's just like, nope.
Like, for better or worse, yeah. Augustine is the most influential voice in Western or all Christianity,
yeah,
but more so than realistically Jesus, which I think is unfortunate.
Right. Yeah. One of his other critiques in this book, and there's many, I highly recommend you read it. Like I said, it's really readable. It's not at all complicated. It's like super, it's like one of those simple but profound books, yeah, that really helps you. It awakens you in so many ways. So I highly recommend it. It's fun too. He really, he throws in some popular culture and stuff in, yeah, the midst. It's kind of a really fun book. But fundamentally, it blows open some things that you haven't even thought about that are really clearly dumb that you just assumed over the years and theological training. And anyway, I found it to be really profound. I loved it. Thank you, Esau, for writing it.
What? All right, I'll finish with one more quote from this because I put the work in, I guess. According to Isaiah, who has come up quite a lot in the prophetic and theological, yes, mindset, who knew?
That's why Jesus quotes him so much.
It's weird how it comes up. It's almost like he had something to say. According to Isaiah, the true practice of religion ought to result in concrete change, the breaking of yokes. He does not mean the occasional practice, the occasional private act of liberation, but to break the chains of injustice.
Mm.
What could this mean other than a transformation of the structures of society that trap people into hopelessness?
Mm.
Jesus has in mind the creation of a new, different type of world. It's interesting that lack of choice. Again, the hopelessness is so,
yeah,
involved with the lack of choice that you mentioned earlier. It's funny how that theme comes up over and over again.
He uses Mary a lot, and since it's, you know, it's that time of year, we might as well just mention this. But he says this one soon. What is the testimony of Mary? The testimony of Mary is that even in the shadow of the empire, there is space for hope, and that sometimes in that space, God calls us from the shadows to join him in his great work of salvation and liberation. Yeah. So this calling for all of us to work together, it's all, and you know, it's, the book is underlined. James, I'm looking through the pages, yeah, here, and it's like, we're going to be here all day if
there
I read
all these. There are
some
pages that have less on than others.
Right, but seriously, yeah, it was a really, really good read. Okay, now we need to end with Brueggemann.
Oh, man.
We said we were going to end with this, and we're going to end with that.
And Danielle is going to embarrass me.
I'm not here to shame anybody. If shame motivated, I'd do it more, but I find shame to be a really bad motivator. So I go with inspiration instead. That's my policy.
Inspire me, Danielle.
Inspire. Shame. Me. Shame's overrated. Okay. So here's just the big one from the prophetic imagination. The prophet engages in futuring fantasy. The prophet does not ask if the vision can be implemented. For questions of implementation are of no consequence until the vision can be imagined. The imagination must come before the implementation. Our culture is competent to implement almost anything and to imagine almost nothing. The same royal consciousness that made it possible to implement anything and everything is the one that shrinks imagination because imagination is a danger. Thus, every totalitarian regime is frightened of the artist. It is the vocation of the prophet to keep alive the ministry of imagination, to keep on conjuring and proposing futures alternative to the single one the king wants us to urge as the only thinkable one. We're kind of back to that, like, I have no choice.
Yeah.
We're kind of almost back. And the prophet is there to sort of go like, nope, look again, look again, look again, to open people's eyes to the possibility of what the kingdom could look like, you know? It's so cool. And that this is your job. You know, this is actually what it is that you're supposed to.
There's a line in Game of Thrones, which, you know, it didn't end well. But there's a line that says, it's hard to imagine a world that's never been. And that stuck with me, as much as not much of that show did by the end. That really stuck with me. And this is why we need more people imagining and more people, again, calling us to account. And when I get into trouble sometimes because I'll say, so why aren't we doing this? Well, you know, it's hard or it's difficult. Mm-hmm. But that's not a good reason.
Right.
Like, so why aren't we doing this thing that is right and just and beautiful and godly and revealing of the kingdom? Like, well, it's more difficult. Like, okay, but that's not a reason.
Another book by him. So that's Prophetic Imagination, which I think is a must read, and James is going to catch up, I'm sure. And then
a short book.
It is a short book. Short book, but it's like so good. You're going to read it and go like, why did it take me so long?
It's embarrassing when that happens. Like, there's a few books that people think I've read.
It's going to be preaching to the choir for you. Sure. Like, you're just going to be like, yes, it's just so beautiful. Like, even if you're preaching to the choir, it's fine.
I need that though.
His other book is called Sabbath as Resistance. He has many books. His other book, that's hilarious. He has many. He has a big library. But like, the other book I think that really speaks to our culture, I think Prophetic Imagination is still a cultural theological gem. Like, we need to like turn it over, read it a few more times to remember that we're actually called to this prophetic imagination. We need to help the world see the possibility of living differently. And then I think now more than ever before. And then I think the Sabbath as Resistance also was this like awakening for me of this view of the Sabbath, not as this sort of like contemplative, passive, sort of like nice thing to do, which it is that as well. But this idea that Sabbath is actually this powerful resistance, this active resistance against a culture that is addicted to commodifying human beings. So this is one of the things he says. Thus, I've come to think that the fourth commandment on Sabbath is the most difficult and most urgent of the commandments in our society, because it summons us to intent and conduct that defies the most elemental requirements of a commodity-propelled society that specializes in control and entertainment, bread and circuses, along with anxiety and violence. See what I mean? Like, it's really beautiful. And then he says this little line about Moses, because this, you know, if you know much about the Sabbath, it became a really big deal post-Exodus as a way of training people not to be slaves. And so Walter Brueggemann writes this about Moses. He says, Moses knows that prosperity breeds amnesia.
It's just so, it just hurts. say that one more time. Say that one more time.
Moses knows that prosperity breeds amnesia.
Someone else listening just like, ooh, it hurts a little bit.
Right. You'll forget that you were ever a slave. You'll forget what oppression is. You'll just forget and then you'll just like repeat history over and over again because you'll forget. And the Sabbath is this remembering. I remember. This is what I'll be, but for the grace of God, I'll be a slave. Not only will I be enslaved, but I will also cause other people to be enslaved as well. And as James and I both missed our day off this week.
Tell people.
We both did it. It was a very busy week. I'm sure everyone else is struggling too. But, you know, it's one of those things where the tyranny of the urgent, right? It got me. All right. And I want to end with this prayer. So this podcast episode is ending on this prayer by Brueggemann. And it's on generosity. And it's from his book, Sabbath, I think. Don't quote me on that. But here's the prayer. On generosity, on our own, we conclude there's not enough to go around. We're going to run short of money, of love, of grades, of publications, of sex, of beer, of members, of years, of life. We should seize the day, seize our goods, seize our neighbor's goods, because there's not enough to go around. And in the midst of our perceived deficit, you come. You come giving bread in the wilderness. You come giving children at the 11th hour. You come giving homes to exiles. You come giving futures to the shut down. You come giving Easter joy to the dead. You come fleshed in Jesus. And we watch while the blind receiving their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor dance and sing. We watch and we take food we did not grow and life we did not invent and future that is gift and gift and gift and families and neighbors who sustain us when we did not deserve it. It dawns on us, late rather than soon, that you give food in due season and you open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing. By your giving, break our cycles of imagined scarcity, override our presumed deficits, quiet our anxieties of lack, transform our perpetual field to see the abundance, mercy upon mercy, blessing upon blessing. Sink your generosity deep into our lives, that your muchness may expose our false lack, that endlessly receiving we may endlessly give, so that the world may be made Easter new, without greedy lack but only wonder, without coercive need but only love, without destructive greed but only praise, without aggression and invasiveness, all things Easter new, all around us, toward us, and by us, all things Easter new. Finish your creation in wonder, love, and praise. Amen.
Amen. We'll